Ladies and gentlemen, our convocation this morning is the first of two programs devoted to the consideration of political topics. Today's program is sponsored by the St. Olaf College YDFL Club. This time I'd like to introduce Mr. Eugene Foley, who is with us, who is candidate for Congress in the 1st District. Mr. Foley. Our guest speaker, the Honorable Mr. Eugene McCarthy, Congressman from the 4th Minnesota District, is a graduate of St. John's University. He received an MA degree from the University of Minnesota in 1939. He has served a number of years on college faculties, teaching in the areas of sociology and economics. During the war, he was connected with the Military Intelligence Division of the War Department. He has been active in the Democratic Farm Labor Party for many years and was a member of the 81st to 84th Congresses. He is at present a candidate for the office of United States Senator. We are pleased at this time to welcome the Honorable Mr. McCarthy to the campus this morning. He will speak to us on the subject, Responsibilities of the United States Senator. Mr. McCarthy.
Dean Loftus, members of the faculty, students of St. Olaf College, my fellow candidate, Eugene Foley, this is a rather pleasant return to St. Olaf, since my previous experiences on this campus have generally been as a representative of St. John's, either in the hockey rink or the baseball field. I'll not go back to the record that was made in the days that I was at St. John's for fear that it might stand against me. Just before I went to St. John's, St. Olaf had a football player named Somers who was the best in Minnesota. And in those days, I recall one game in which I think St. John's was defeated 86-0. That was when I was in prep school there. And I remember we sent in a substitute, I didn't, but the college, and this is a story that goes on. And the score at that time, I think, was 75-0, and there were about 2 minutes left to play. This man's name was Hermanutz. He was a German from Stearns County. This was Hermanutz's first game, and as he went in, he said, "Come on, fellows, we can beat these Norwegians yet." Well, that was the spirit of St. John's back in those days. Now, in this campaign, I don't want to put the issue on that particular basis, but we do have a little bit of a problem with regard to nationality and party differences in this campaign. I think I should give you this warning. I don't know whether you're permitted to leave a convocation once it's started or not, but since there's been so much guilt by association in American politics recently, I thought that you ought to know that the Republican State Committee is circulating an excerpt from an editorial that appeared in the Truman Tribune. Now, I don't know whether you're familiar with that publication. You may know where Truman, Minnesota is. This is not Harry Truman's publication. And the excerpt from the editorial says, in effect, that a vote for McCarthy is a vote for the atheistic dictator Walter Reuther from Detroit. But now I hope that you'll not hold me responsible to that extent. We'll not hold any of you responsible if the Truman Tribune should turn out to be right. I suppose this editorial or an excerpt from it may appear in the Northfield paper. You know, these Minnesota editors seem to have a kind of common practice whereby if one of them writes something that's somewhat irresponsible, the others feel they can reprint it without taking responsibility for the first printing. And so around the state, occasionally I see an objective editorial reprinted from the Northfield paper, generally attacking McCarthy, Blue Earth, or some other part of the state where I'm sure the people don't quite know who the editor is up here and know what his background is. Well, even the Minneapolis paper came out against me the other day, and I thought they made an interesting argument last Sunday. They said that really in the final determination of this election, that the voters ought to keep in mind that if they elect me, that this would in effect be an admission that the voters had been mistaken with regard to my opponent for 16 years. Well, that's a strange kind of argument, you know. I have to point out to the Republicans that they never made this argument in the campaigns during which I've been running for re-election, even though they were quite persuaded that the people had been mistaken in St. Paul when they first elected me in 48, again in 50 and 52 and 54 and 56. But the newspaper never did come out and say, keep on re-electing McCarthy so that you don't have to admit publicly that you made a mistake in 1948. But I think that we realize this is a rather ridiculous argument, since it's pretty well established in this country that every 6 years we should hold a senatorial election, and that in those particular years, the people have a right in the secrecy of the ballot box to, they don't have to say it publicly, but they can go in and admit their mistakes by changing their position. And I do hope that the position taken by the Minneapolis Tribune will not prevail as the dominant argument, at least in this campaign. Now that I'm on the campus at St. Olaf, I suppose I should respond to a telegram which I understand I've received from Mr. Andy Anderson, who seems to be in line to become the philosopher of the Republican Party. I've not heard his explanation of what a Republican is, but he wants to discuss the basic differences in principle between the two parties. And I'd like to make this statement clearly, that if Andy can assure us of an audience which has at least 100 bona fide Republicans, that we'll come out and debate the issue. But I'd suggest to him in the meantime, while he's waiting to get that kind of a crowd, that he hold a conference of the Republican candidates in this state, and that they among themselves try to agree as to what a Republican is. If they can come to this common agreement, then I would suggest that they get some stickers made and go around the state and take a look at all the billboards the Republicans have put up, because those that I've seen have no indication that their candidates are Democrats or Republicans or vegetarians. So this would be helpful, I think, if they just would say, we agree, we know what Republicans are, and all of these are Republicans. And when they come to that kind of common agreement, then I think we can get on to some fundamental discussion of differences in principle and also differences between the programs of the two parties. Well, my point today is to talk to you about the very special responsibilities of a United States Senator. In the course of the history of this United States, there have been some significant changes that have taken place in the relationship between the various branches of our federal government, and also in the relationship and the function of the House of Representatives and of the United States Senate. When the Constitution was drawn, major emphasis was placed upon the House of Representatives. It was expected to be the dominant body to formulate legislative policy and to give general direction to the whole course of government and to the historic growth of the United States. And among the early national leaders, people like James Madison, for example, refused to run for the United States Senate, saying that any man who had any hope to be a political influence in this country should stay in the House of Representatives. And Daniel Webster at one time refused to run for the Senate. Well, of course, that has changed, as you know. The general movement now is from the House to the Senate. Approximately one-third of the senators were men who formerly served in the House of Representatives. And so when I was making my decision to leave what was considered a safe seat in the House and to make the race for the Senate, I gave some thought to this transition and this change in the relationship and in the responsibilities of the two bodies. And the two most important changes, I think, these occurred over a long period of time, and historic forces such as the Civil War and the growth of the nation and the increase in foreign policy, all of these have important bearings upon the change which has taken place. But in any case, at this time, it is my opinion that the Senate, I would say, is the most important. At least it is the body of the Congress which has the greatest measure of responsibility. It has the ordinary obligations, or the members of that body have the ordinary obligations of participating in the formulation of legislation and in the passage of that legislation. They must vote and take a stand on everything, excepting special resolutions which may be passed by the House. But in addition to that, they have under the Constitution and in the traditions of the United States a very special kind of obligation in the field of foreign policy. And this is an obligation which takes on new meanings and new burdens as foreign policy continues to become more important in the government of this United States. And in addition to that, they have a very special responsibility with regard to the conduct of the executive branch of the government in the confirmation of cabinet members, in the approval of various other appointees to commissions and agencies and high positions in the government. But these additional responsibilities, I say, have become increasingly burdensome. And so the office of the United States Senate, to the extent that the responsibilities increase, becomes all the more important. Taking into account this general trend, and taking into account also, at least the opinion that I have, which I think is sustained by an examination of the history of this country, that in any period when you have uncertain leadership in the White House, when you have hesitation, when there's general confusion, that then it becomes important that the Senate speak out strongly and that it act decisively. And I would say that this need for strength in the Senate and for decisive action is one which should be more or less built into the institutions of our government, if not by changes in procedure and actual organization, at least by changes in the traditional concept of the function of a United States Senator and of his responsibilities. Because as we look to the future in this country, particularly in the field of foreign policy, but also in the field of domestic policy and domestic program, I think most of us are persuaded that we can't approach these problems any longer in terms of a year by year or a change every 2 years or every 4 years in the case of presidential elections or even every 6 years. But that we must lay down some long-range plans, that we must project these programs, and that if we're going to do that, there must be in the government at some point a kind of line of succession or a line of continuity in which responsibility continues, not only responsibility in the government, but an acceptance of the responsibility of taking to the people and of keeping before the people the problems and the issues upon which the government must decide. And this can best be done through the United States Senate, which has a measure of continuity built into it under the Constitution, which beyond that has become the great form of public debate in this United States. What is said by a United States Senator is heard not only in the Senate, it should be heard by the people of his own state. And if what he has to say is of real importance, it is ordinarily heard also by the people of the entire United States, and there is even some response to it among the peoples of Western Europe or the rest of the world. Since these statements of policy or of program are of such vital importance, not only to one's own state, but to the nation, and also to all of the other peoples throughout the world who are responsive to our programs and who are in some measure dependent upon us, either for help or for leadership. Well, now, as you know, when I decided to run for the Senate, my own party didn't stand up as one man and acclaim me. I wasn't exactly drafted. We had some problems at a convention in Rochester and some slight opposition in the primary election. But in any case, at this point, I am the endorsed and nominated candidate of the Democratic Farmer Labor Party. And so I want to present myself to you and to the people of the state, not as a separate and individual candidate for office without any general responsibilities for his party, but as the candidate of the Democratic Farmer Labor Party. Because every candidate must carry into a campaign, I think, a twofold burden, that which is of his own making and that which is of the making, I suppose we could say, of his own political party. Now, the opposition has raised some questions. They've suddenly become very concerned about the fact that I've given up seniority in the House of Representatives. Said he was there for 10 years and evidently a most valuable member. But again, I must make the point that they were never concerned about my seniority when I was running for re-election in the past. And I think I must make this one point, that when a man comes up for re-election, he really takes two things to the people: his record and his program, and his seniority. And if he's quite satisfied with his record and his program, this is what he emphasizes. But if he'd rather not talk about his record and his program, then he talks about seniority. Now, I think I must make this one point, that in the Congress of the United States, if you stay in office, you get older. You can't avoid it. And so you develop seniority. But this notion of seniority is a great force in American politics, is, I think, the one point which is most overemphasized. And so I hope you'll not be particularly moved by that. But if this is to be, I decided that maybe I ought to check into the question and see really how much time I might be able to spend in the Senate if I were elected. And I checked the mortality tables of the insurance company, and I found that according to their estimates, if both my opponent and I live out our allotted time, that is our time allotted by, I think it was Metropolitan Life Insurance Company, which may not be the time allotted to us in fact, you know, that they estimate that the senator should be good for 16 more years, which added to the 12 he spent in the Senate gives him 28. They estimate that I should be good for 35. So if you take the 35 and subtract the 28, why, I'm good for about 7 more years of service. Well, I don't argue that this is the issue in the campaign, but I raise this point simply because it's been raised against me. I do hope that people will not consult the Metropolitan Life Insurance actuarial reports and estimates in making up their minds in this campaign. I want to talk to you principally about foreign policy. And to preface my remarks with this qualification, really, that there is a limitation upon the measure of responsibility which a United States senator has for the foreign policy of his own party. The principal responsibility rests, of course, upon the administration itself, the president and the State Department, and the other executive offices that are charged with the obligation of conducting foreign policy. But the senator of a party which does control the White House must take some responsibility. To the extent that he has some obligation with regard to the election and the establishment in office of his own party, and secondly, too, because the Senate is a body which can exercise some influence and give some direction to foreign policy. We have in the campaign thus far, I think, talked perhaps too much about agriculture, but I was challenged particularly in that field. One of the earliest statements made by Senator Thigh was to the effect that I was totally ignorant of agriculture. Well, you always hate to be called totally ignorant. Not only that, but if someone calls you totally ignorant in any field, you don't have to prove very much to prove that he's wrong. And so I thought that this raised an issue which I couldn't very well pass up altogether. And so we have pursued the question of agriculture, in part because this special emphasis was placed upon it, but also in part because it is a great issue and of great importance to the people of Minnesota, since it is at the base of our whole economy and the welfare of small business as well as the welfare of our industries and our service agencies and our financial institutions in this state do depend upon it in great measure. But I say I think we have discussed that issue quite fully, and I do hope that at least within the next 2 weeks we'll have made clear the record of the differences and the disagreements which we have in that particular field. I hope that, perhaps I shouldn't even raise this question, but there have been two or three rather but I think side issues that have been raised in this field and in other fields, and I want to make quite clear that so far as I can affirm my position, that I'm not in favor of noxious weeds, as the senator indicated on one occasion. And I want to support his recent statement that he's against the poachers up in northern Minnesota. I don't know that either noxious weeds or poachers in Minnesota are great issues in a Senate campaign. But since they've been raised, why, I think I ought to make my position clear at this point. The field of foreign policy is one, I think, which is of greatest importance to us. Now, within the last 2 weeks, the Vice President has made a statement saying that the attitudes of the people in this field cannot be depended upon because they're uninformed. And the President, a few days later, made a special point of objecting to and protesting against any criticism of foreign policy. Well, now, if the criticism involves informing the people, which it should if it's honest criticism, then we find ourselves in this situation, that the Vice President says the people aren't informed, and therefore no attention should be paid to them in the field of foreign policy. And the President, in effect, says that at least in the immediate future, no one should undertake to inform them. Well, this puts us in an almost impossible situation, really, with regard to individual and citizen responsibility in foreign affairs. On the one hand, to say you shouldn't inform them, on the other hand, to say they're not informed and therefore their attitudes and their response to foreign policy should not be considered. As foreign policy becomes more important, it becomes vitally necessary that the people be informed, not to be consulted on every tactical change or every move, but to have them informed with regard to the basic issues and the basic problems. Informed to the point where they can make an intelligent decision and indicate the direction, at least, in which they would like to have our international program advanced. And this, it seems to me, is a very special kind of obligation which must be accepted in the course of a campaign for the United States Senate. If we had a system of government such as the British have, when a decision of the government can be taken immediately to the people, or almost immediately to the people, it might be different. Under the cabinet system and the parliamentary system, the government can be brought down if its decisions are not acceptable to the people. Under our system, such action cannot be taken excepting in election years. And so it is vitally important that the great problems which face the nation should be discussed in election years. And so I'd like to talk to you about foreign policy. Not to pass judgment on the failure of the administration in certain limited areas or in certain particular instances, because I think all of us realize that the international situation is such that we can't expect success in every move or success from day to day, but rather to pass judgment upon the conduct of our foreign policy over the period of the last 6 years, to try to set a kind of standard for judgment against the movement of history. And this, it seems to me, is eminently fair and eminently necessary. And so let's go back to 1952, when this administration was established in power, and see what the situation was. Well, no one would say that all the problems of the world were solved, but at least the movement was forward. The United States and its allies had the initiative. The Korean War was in its last stages. The North Atlantic Treaty Organization had been well established, and it appeared as though genuine stability might be established in Western Europe. The Middle East was, of course, a danger spot, but there was no open outbreak. And in the Far East, we looked hopefully to some solution, at least, of the problems there. In South America, the good neighbor policy at least was accepted. It may not have been very effectively carried out, but there was no public protest against it. And in North Africa, so far as we could determine, we had some friends and we had some respect and some support, particularly among the Arab people of that part of the world. Well, in 1952, there was a campaign for the presidency. And I'd like to review some of the charges and some of the criticism directed against the democratic foreign policy which had been in effect. The Korean War was labeled Truman's War. The Republican candidates spoke of liberation as opposed to what they call the immoral policy of containment. They talked about unleashing Chiang Kai-shek and of no longer using the Seventh Fleet to protect the Chinese communists on the mainland from the Chinese nationalists on Formosa. The presidential candidate said that he was going to repudiate all secret agreements which had been entered into before he became president. And they said that instead of the international posture of paralyzed tension, that we were going to have a new, bold, and dynamic foreign policy. Well, what is the situation today? The policy of liberation is no longer mentioned. It died more or less when the Hungarian revolt was suppressed by the communists, and we stood by, making feeble protests, but putting our principal emphasis upon the action of our allies, the British and French, in the Suez area. There's not much talk about unleashing Chiang Kai-shek in these days. And I think all of us know what function the Seventh Fleet is fulfilling today. When the president was asked which secret agreements he wished to repudiate, for he said he was going to send up a resolution to the Congress, he said he didn't know of any. And he never did send the resolution to Congress. Yet in the campaign, he said he was going to repudiate them and send a resolution to Congress listing the ones that he wanted Congress to repudiate along with him. The posture of paralyzed tension, as we look back upon it, looks bold and dynamic in contrast with the actions of this administration. But let me see that there are three general areas, I think, in which we have failed to respond, really, to the test of our time. The first has been that of the matter of defense. Now, I'm not concerned particularly about the problems of physical defense. I think that we're not in a position where we need to surrender to the communists or to anyone else at this time. I'm concerned more about what I think are the moral implications of the defense policy which this administration continuously emphasizes. The policy of massive retaliation, first noted by John Foster Dulles and then more or less accepted by the administration. The policy, if we are to believe Dulles and if we are to believe Life magazine, of taking this country to the brink of war repeatedly in order to settle our international problems, and of always holding back the threat that we will use the atomic or the hydrogen bomb. Now, you may recall in 1955, as we went through that year, all of the emphasis in the releases of the administration and in the press, too, were to this effect, that we were making progress because the rest of the world realized that the president wanted to secure peace by peaceful means. Well, after we'd gone along with that, suddenly there appeared an article in Life magazine in which John Foster Dulles said the reason we'd made progress was that he had taken the country to the brink of war three times. Well, now we're not sure which is right, but the point is that we couldn't have been pursuing the two policies at the same time. And of course, it's distressing to have the official policy of the administration explained not by the administration itself, or explained not in a white paper in the traditional manner, but having it explained to us in Time magazine or in Life magazine. And of course, if you disagree with the position stated by Time and Life, you can always wait and read about it in the Reader's Digest. This is the final point of appeal if you're trying to discover what the real policy of the administration is. But I say they have failed to face up to the moral implications of what they talk about when they speak of massive retaliation. And when they say we, of course, have the final shield of the hydrogen bomb, there's been no forward movement to try to solve the moral problems of the fact that we do possess, and I suppose in part the fact that we carry some burden of guilt for for having been the first to use atomic weapons. The second general area of failure, which I think is most significant, is our seeming failure to understand the meaning and the significance of Western civilization and of Western culture in this conflict with communism. The general indication that we think that each one of the nations of the Western world can more or less go its own way. That the problems of the French, for example, in North Africa are of no concern to us. Or the problems which we have in Little Rock, Arkansas, and in other parts of the United States, that these are of no concern to the people of France or of England. What we ought to realize is that the basic test in this contest with communism is really a test of what we call Western civilization. And so this should be one of our principal concerns, to consolidate the nations of the West, not necessarily in a political way, but in a cultural way, to have them come to some understanding of their common problems, and to have them accept some common responsibilities for their faults and failings. Khrushchev, in a speech about a year and a half ago, I think, did very well for us in telling us what was involved. He said that, in not just these words, but in essence, that the free democracies and what you call Western civilization claims that it is the superior order because it has stood the test of peace and prosperity. But he said, peace and prosperity is no time of test or trial. Any political system or any philosophy of life can stand up under those conditions, he said. And he said, you say that you've stood the test of all-out war. But then he went on to say, this is no test either, because under conditions of all-out war, you adopt the methods and the techniques of totalitarianism. And this was something of an extreme statement, but in part it was true. And then he said, in this period of the Cold War, this time of uncertainty and tension, he said, we mean to put you to the absolute and to the final test, to see whether in time of trial, in time of tension, your system is superior to ours. And I think we ought to realize that when he said, we're going to try you in every field, we're going to try you in the field of military action, if need be, in the field of scientific advance, we're going to try you to see whether your system is more productive than our system is, to try you as to whether or not your general culture is superior to ours. And I think we should realize that he has us at something of a disadvantage, because he can point to the fact that Western civilization and Western culture has dominated the world for some 400 or 500 years at least. And so they can list all of our faults and failings and say these are signs of the inadequacies of your system. While they, on the other hand, don't really have a record, all they have to set up and to present are a set of promises. They can criticize and denounce, and this is the nature of their appeal, particularly to the neutral and the uncommitted people, and make claims as to what they can achieve if they are established in power. And so I think that this realization that this is a kind of total challenge, what has been described by one historian as the total challenge of history. And I say, I see no indication that this administration or its spokesman have any realization that we are involved in this kind of contest. And the third is a general indication of our failure to understand, really, the neutral nations of the world, to understand their aspirations for some kind of national identity, some kind of cultural identity, to understand their aspirations to escape from institutional poverty and the kind of distress which so many of them suffer from now. That all too often when we approach these problems, it's in terms of forcing some kind of political or economic commitment from these people. I think the worst example, perhaps, was manifest in relation to the debate in the House of Representatives and also in the Senate, but principally in the House of Representatives, on the proposition that we should send wheat to India, where the people were starving in great numbers. And the argument was made that we should withhold such aid unless the Indians denounced their policy of neutralism. In other words, a kind of soup kitchen approach to international affairs in which we said, unless you people will stand up and endorse American foreign policy, in effect, say the United States is the greatest nation in the world, and we will do anything they want us to do. It was not quite that extreme, but this was implicit in it, that we will withhold from you even the wheat that you need to feed your starving people. Well, I say, actually, the communists don't have to make up anything for their propaganda. They can find almost anything they want in the congressional record. On almost every issue, some irresponsible statements have been made. Now, I know that this is a problem, this problem of individual statements and of extremists, which we cannot overcome in a free society. But we can overcome it if it's established in the minds of the people of the world that the United States understands these basic problems, and that the great mass of our people do accept this responsibility and are willing to move ahead constructively in all of these areas. This, it seems to me, is the great challenge to the people of this country, and the great challenge, too, to any man who seeks to represent the United States in the Senate of this United States. First of all, to know his own people, and to know his state, and to know its problems. But beyond that, to accept responsibility, insofar as he can, and this, of course, involves cooperation, the acceptance of responsibility on the part of everyone who has the obligation to inform and to help to form the mind and the will of the people of a state. But to go beyond that and accept the responsibility of speaking for his people. This is the responsibility, I think, of leadership. It's in the same nature as the responsibility to educate. It's not a question of having people stand up and march behind you. This is not the way of leadership or direction in a democracy. This is the basic problem which Edmund Burke wrote about in discussing the responsibilities of representative government and the responsibility of a man who seeks to represent his people. And he said that such a man had a very clear obligation to do something more than simply reflect what he considered to be the popular opinion. For as he said, at that time, of course, the crown had some strength. That if this were to be the case, then you would no longer really have popular representation and no longer have leadership of the people, but a kind of continuous surrender to that which was held to at the mean or at the average. And so in conclusion, let me say to you, particularly you students, that you must keep these one or two points in mind. That the problems which face this country are not becoming somewhat more simple, but the obligations which you must accept as citizens and prospective citizens are becoming increasingly difficult. And so you must keep in mind that citizenship in a democracy does not make life somehow more simple for you. It doesn't make things easier for you. But what it requires is this, that in addition to all of the other obligations that you must accept in a free society, the obligations that you will have as members of a family, the special obligations imposed upon you as members of a profession, or as men and women pursuing a particular vocation, and all of the other obligations that go with membership in the other institutions of our society, the educational and the religious institutions, and all of that complex that makes up this free society, you must accept the additional obligation and responsibility of full participation in citizenship in this United States. And this, too, you must keep in mind, that in a democratic society, and I refer only to the political aspects of it, we cannot be content, really, if we do succeed to this point of establishing an order which is based upon justice. We say this is the objective of all political activity. But even though we were to succeed to this point, so that we could say, well, here is a society in which all relationships are ordered in justice, this in itself would not be the fulfillment of the ideal of democracy. Because in addition to that kind of external or objective order, if we are truly to succeed, we must accomplish also this objective, namely to have that order and the good in that society understood by the people who make up that society, and not only understood by them, not only comprehended in an intellectual way, but also to have that good society the object of their desire and the object of their will. This is the full obligation and the full responsibility of citizenship in a democratic society.